from WCPB Channel 5 Podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 Podcast. Today's guest, Jen McCaffrey from The Athletic. She's going to help us break down the Red Sox. Jen came up with the perfect theme for this team. We have two Brock Holtz. That's definitely going to get people packing Fenway. Also, we talk about the patience the Red Sox will need to show as they move through Chaim Bloom's rebuild here. We asked Jen if Red Sox ownership and the fan base really has enough patience to let Chaim Bloom do what he's doing, which is basically build a real team in the background while the team at the forefront at the major league level is simply passable. Also, one Ellen Fleming would like to talk about rule changes in Major League Baseball. She wants the sport to be more entertaining and played at a quicker pace. Isn't that right, Ellen?
Well, yes. Like I've said a million times on this podcast, sports are entertainment first and foremost. And we talk about how the statistics and the strategy behind the game is actually slowing the game down. And Jen is much more of a purist when it comes to these things. I am much more, let's make this as more exciting as possible. I'm a let's put a Ray tank in every field across America kind of person. And so those are the, you know, I think those are the two points of view that are being talked about when it comes to Major League Baseball right now and how these new rules might speed up the game, might slow down the game, may even create more action. But Jen is more concerned with taking away from the traditional baseball, what the sport is actually about. And I'm more like, let's get out there, speed up this game. We got things to do.
Yeah, you want to make sure you can still catch that episode of the Housewives Reunion while watching the Red Sox.
Yes, and I want to like be able to leave Fenway after having a few drinks and go across the street to a bar and still have ample time.
You still know what I mean? Bar be open.
Exactly. Yeah.
The Red Sox do play some of the longest games in Major League Baseball, but this is a Major League Baseball issue overall. I'm sort of in the middle of you guys. I'm okay with some tinkering with the game. One thing I'm very much in favor of, as you know, I say bring on the robots. It's their world now, not ours. Robot umps. I'm all about the robot umps. If I could make any change, it would be robot umps. I stand robot umps.
I don't like the robot umps. I don't like them at all. I like when umps mess up. I think it's part of the game. I know no one agrees with me, but I like to have that human element of making mistakes.
But the human element of making mistakes is exactly what slows down the game. If the robot umps were getting all the strike calls right, you'd have time to go across the street, go to the Cask and Flagon, grab a couple of beers, go home, and still watch your shows.
I want the players and the coaches to still be able to get in fights with the umps.
Oh, okay. Entertainment. This okay. is what it's about. Yeah, like, oh, here we go.
I want dirt being kicked on the shins of those umpires. That's what I want, okay? And that's what it comes down to.
You want people to be able to make a scene. Well, I have news for you. Replay already has taken some of that away because instead of screaming in each other's faces or kicking the dirt, the guy will just come out, the manager will just come out and take his finger up in the air and do the whirly bird sign saying, I want you to look at that on replay. So we've already kind of lost that a little bit.
We just can't go any further.
Well, I want robot umps. You know, Ellen does not want robot umps. So we'll talk about that. And also just the outlook for the Red Sox season. Nobody better to break it down with than Jen McCaffrey of The Athletic. She's next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right, as promised, we're now joined by Jen McCaffrey. She covers the Red Sox for The Athletic. Jen, thanks for joining us today here on the Take 5 podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. So obviously, a little bit of an interesting season here for the Red Sox. And I want to start here with Alex Cora coming back. That seems to be, honestly, when I look at it, sort of the root of the optimism about this team being able to bounce back from a last place finish last year in the American League East at 24-36 during the COVID season. So what have you noticed in terms of Alex's impact so far on the Red Sox in his second stint?
Yeah, honestly, it's like he never left. And I know, yeah, some people probably don't want to hear that, but he's been very kind of forthcoming in terms of, you know, what he did and the punishment he had and kind of answers every single question that's, you know, thrown his way about you know, having this be on his resume for the rest of his career, rest of his life. So, I mean, he's going to continue to answer more of those questions, especially as the season starts, you know, especially as the team goes on the road and, you know, the fans are more fans are in the stands. This is going to be a thing he's going to have to deal with throughout the season. But from the player side, it seems, you know, things kind of picked up where they left off. And, you know, he had played a big part in, you know, Rafael Devers' career early on. And, you know, that seems to kind of be going just as well now, too. And, you know, obviously with JD and Bogarts and Eduardo Rodriguez, all those guys spoke so highly of Alex and just the way he communicates and the way he manages. And I think that they really just take to him, and they really just kind of enjoy his personality and the way he goes about things. And I think, you know, that is kind of going to be an underlying factor in how this team performs this year, in that he can maybe get a little bit more out of guys because he just sees things on their level and is able to speak their language, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. There's no question in my mind that the Red Sox are sort of banking on Alex being able to get more out of guys who are already on the roster, like you mentioned, like JD, you know, like Rafael Devers, even like Eduardo Rodriguez. Obviously extenuating circumstances for Erod last year with the myocarditis following the coronavirus. And now we know he's not going to be the opening day starter because of dead arm. Nathan Eovaldi will get the call Thursday against the Orioles at Fenway. How concerned are the Red Sox about that? And how concerned should we be? Because, I mean, let's be honest, Erod has a history of injuries, Jen. And also, in his history of injuries, it normally starts out with them being like, oh, this is like a minor thing, like the time in spring training he sort of fell off the mound and wrenched his knee. And then it always turns out to be a much bigger deal with Erod.
Yeah, look, I don't think you can't say that there's no level of concern just because he's coming off of, you know, this myocarditis, and we don't really know what the long-term effects of these things are. He looked really good this spring, and I mean, that's one thing you can kind of hang your hat on, is that it's not like he came out of the gate, you know, limping along and, you know, really winded and whatever. He pitched really well in those four outings, those four starts that he had before kind of experiencing this dead arm in the fifth start. It's definitely something to keep an eye on. They're, the way that they're terming it, and, you know, like you said, they tend to do this too, is just that they're being extra cautious, and they should be extra cautious because we, like we said, we don't really know, you know, what the long-term effects are here. But it does, at this point at least, sound like it's only going to be kind of like a, you know, a week, 10 days into the season, miss maybe the first turn through the rotation, and then he'll be back, and potentially Tanner Houck will kind of take that spot. That's kind of what we're expecting. There's things you can point to, I guess, if you're looking for optimism there. And I honestly think it's only going to be, you know, a week or two into the season, and then he'll be back.
Hopefully you're right. And I think optimism is the theme of Red Sox spring training, you know, which they wrapped up on Tuesday. But, you know, I look at it and it's sort of camp optimism. That's, you know, they're optimistic about everything. But in terms of Erod and the injury, and I know they're different players, but I just go back to, and I know you were there, you know, spring training really before the pandemic. One of the last sporting things I covered normally was Red Sox spring training. And I was there for like Chris Sale, and it was like, oh, you know, he's going to throw off the mound, or he's going to, you know, he's going to throw BP. I forget what they called it. It wasn't like, it was like enhanced BP. He's going to throw enhanced BP. And it was like, oh, it's no big deal. And then all of a sudden I was like, yep, Tommy John, you know? So I would say the Red Sox don't have the greatest track record. I'm not saying Eduardo Rodriguez is headed toward Tommy John, but I'm just saying, I remember being there for the Chris Sale thing. And it was like all these sort of incremental steps he was going to do, and it, don't worry about it, no big deal. And then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, he has Tommy John and he's shut down.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely a valid point that there is a track record there of kind of downplaying things. And I think they try to, you know, get ahead of things before they snowball too quickly, and then kind of end up having to admit after the fact that they should have just gotten ahead of things ahead of time. The one thing that I guess you can look to is, if he is out for an extended period of time, they do have Tanner Houck, and they do have, you know, more depth, much more depth than they did last year when they were kind of putting guys like Ryan Weber and Chris Mazza out there to start, using 16 different pitchers to start. This year, you know, Matt Andrees they have in the bullpen, and, you know, even that Garrett Whitlock, who they stretched out a little bit, who's going to be in there, that Rule 5.
Yeah, he's pitched very well.
Yeah, so I mean, if, you know, Rodriguez is out for much longer, and if this does end up being similar to past experiences where it's a bigger deal than what we think it is, I think they're padded a little bit more with that depth. And, you know, that's obviously something Chaim Bloom has, you know, preached all since he came here, really, but all off season.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really great point on sort of the depth and the flexibility. And you mentioned all the pitchers they used last year. And I think if there's one quote that encompassed what the Red Sox experience was last year, it was interim manager Ron Renicki saying, "Who do we have that's better than Ryan Weber?"
Who do we have that we can say that we're going to put in that's going to be better than Ryan?
To me, that was, I mean, that's one of the great quotes in Red Sox history. It's up there with, you know, Lou Gorman's, "The sun will rise, the sun will set, and I'll have lunch." And also, "What would we do with Willie McGee?" That's one of the great quotes in the history of the Boston Red Sox. If you're just looking to crystallize what the Red Sox experience was last year, it was definitely Renicki saying, "Who do we have that's better than Ryan Weber?" And this year they feel like they have a lot of guys better than Ryan Weber. And I feel like that's the biggest sort of hinge point or pendulum point, Jen, for the Red Sox this year. It has to be the starting pitching, because last year they were 25th in Major League Baseball in starters ERA at 5.34. And honestly, a lot of these games for them were over, done, finished the moment they sent the starter to the mound.
The rotation is where it kind of all lies. You know, the health and kind of, yeah, just strength of this rotation. You know, you've got guys with injury histories. We've talked about Rodriguez, but, you know, Evaldi always ends up having, you know, some sort of issue throughout the year. And Garrett Richards, his last year was his first real year back from Tommy John surgery, and he hadn't pitched a full 30 start season since, I think, 2015. So there are concerns. Don't get me wrong. You know, there's more depth, but there are definitely, you know, health concerns. And I think, you know, that's kind of why they tried to add some, you know, all these extra arms throughout the winter. Was kind of like, here's another extra arm, here's another extra arm. But it was like, there's a point for that. And, you know, they didn't want to be in the place that they were last year. But, you know, I think that they'll get by and, you know, be a better than 500 team, which I think at this point is sort of what people are expecting. You know, a 500 or better would be kind of the goal compared to last year. So I think it does lie all in the rotation and how these, and getting off to a good start in these first few games, first few weeks, especially when you have six of your first nine games against the Orioles, is going to be key for them.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, you have an article up on The Athletic. It's a Red Sox preview, key questions facing a retooled team, predictions that you did. And I want to talk to you about one of them, because it's related to what we're talking about, which is starting pitching. And I always look at baseball and I feel like, even with the idea of a little bit of the change of the sort of the prevailing notion in baseball, maybe a de-emphasization of starters with the whole idea of the opener and the bulk pitcher that comes after, I still think that starting pitching is a lot like presidents and presidential elections. You know, it's the economy stupid. It's the starting pitching stupid. I feel like that always sort of applies. So one of the things that you mentioned in your article here is the idea of when Chris Sale will be back. And I'm just sort of curious, do you think the Red Sox are factoring a Chris Sale return into the rotation?
I don't think they're banking on him. I think they're optimistic he's going to be back sometime in the second half, but they're definitely not, from, you know, everything that we've heard, they're definitely not counting on him to be like a guy for them in the second half. I think they really are just counting on him to get healthy again and to make sure he can make it back, and anything else would be nice. You know, I think they set up the rotation the way they did, because they weren't expecting him to be back for at least, you know, 3 months into the season. And so he's just, I think his surgery anniversary was a couple days ago. So he's a year out. You know, this 12 to 18 month timetable is what a lot of guys end up falling into. He's at 12 months. He still hasn't gotten off a mound yet. He's had a couple of setbacks. He had COVID. It was asymptomatic, but still that sets you back. And haven't talked too much about this, but this kind of like nerve neck issue that he dealt with in December, and Rob Bradford at WEEI kind of delved a little bit into it and talked to him a little bit about it, but Sale didn't divulge too much information. But it sounds like something, you know, just trying to keep the arm, the neck loose and that kind of thing. But it's something to keep an eye on. So, I mean, we talked to Dave Bush, the pitching coach, maybe a week or two ago, and just talked about these kind of incremental steps and, you know, 10 pitches to 15 pitches and 90 feet to 120 feet. And it's, you know, I think when people think of Tommy John recovery, they're looking at the big picture, but when you're in it, you really have to look at the baby steps. And it's frustrating for fans that want to see him out there. They know he signed this big contract extension, you know, and they want to see the fruits of that labor, but it's time consuming. And, you know, the last thing they want to do is rush him and have him break down again and, you know, not have him for, you know, the future years.
just out of people they've brought in, and I want to include some of the maybe prospect guys in this too, like a Connor Siebold. I know Nick Pivetta is in the rotation. I'm not sure what's up with Brian Mata. He's having some elbow injury problems, is a better way of putting it right now, and he's one of their top pitching prospects. But when you look at sort of the depth they've accumulated in starting pitching, you know, is there a guy to you that stands out, a sleeper who could turn out to be maybe better than we think for the Sox in the rotation?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like all those guys are kind of, you know, really intriguing names that have shown, you know, a lot of promise over the spring. And, you know, you're not banking on spring numbers by any means, because that's, you know, always a crapshoot. But there have been some, you know, interesting performances that you're kind of like, maybe this guy is something more. Maybe Heimblum does have a plan that, you know, this is all going to pan out in the end and he's going to have the last laugh. But yeah, I mean, you look at a guy like Whitlock, you know, picked up in the Rule 5 draft, and we talked about him, and it's not just about the spring numbers, but the velocity that he's shown. And just, he's another guy that came off Tommy John. And it seems like, you know, that's been a really interesting, you know, pickup for them. He has to stay on the roster all season because he's a Rule 5 guy. And, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, gone after him if they didn't think that he could stick. And he's shown this spring that he can be good. For fans who haven't been paying close attention and who's to blame them, I think that'll be someone that they're kind of, you know, going to be wanting to know more about. We know about Tanner Houck and what he did last year. And part of the reason why they wanted him to kind of start at the alternate site and even in Worcester to start the year was to kind of work on that third pitch, to work on the splitter. And, you know, his results this spring were mixed. Again, we're not, you know, looking too much into the results, but you do want to make sure, you know, a guy that's a starting pitcher in the majors has at least a third pitch to rely on. So you're not just going on fastball slider there. You're not going to get through the Yankees lineup, you know, with just that.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think, you know, at the end of last season, it was sort of like, it was such a, you know, everyone points to those three tremendous starts that he had. But I think at the same time, you kind of have to be realistic of, you know, where teams were at the end of the last season and kind of, you know, maybe not expecting this kid to come in and light things up. So there's promising things from that, but you also want him to work on a couple things. At the same time, you know, I think he can take that step forward and be someone that's, you know, maybe going to be, you know, this homegrown pitching prospect that they haven't had since what John Lester played Buchholz,
you know, 10
years, right? So I mean, you know, got Connor Siebold in that you know, Phillies trade last year for Brandon Workman and Heath Hembree along with Nick Pivetta. Pivetta's going to be a piece of the rotation this year, and I know he's had a rough stretch in Philly, is kind of looking to turn things around in his career, and maybe this is the place where he's going to do that. But Siebold's a guy that's kind of basically right behind Houck, I guess, in you know, in that AAA pecking order for starters. So he's someone you might see by the end of the summer. Mata, you mentioned that with the injury. I think that he's kind of backed up a little bit because of that. He hasn't thrown in a long time. They're kind of taking their time with treatment there. So he probably would have been someone that was kind of, you know, next in line. But I think that's kind of been backed up a little bit just because of the injury. So there are interesting names here.
I also wanted to just ask you about a couple of other things that stand out to me about this team and level of success. And so one of them obviously is second base. Last year, the Sox last in Major League Baseball in OPS from second baseman. It was a cumulative 0.586, so 586 there. They bring in Kike Hernandez, who, interestingly enough, has signed the longest contract that Chaim Bloom has offered. He's on a two-year deal. So you see how Chaim's bringing this team together and building it a little bit. How much of a difference do you think Kike will make? I know that they're really high on him as the leadoff hitter, guy coming from the Dodgers, has won a World Series. What kind of difference do you think he will make? And also, I'm really, my favorite offseason signing was Marwin Gonzalez. I know we had a down year last year, but he's a guy that Alex knows from his time with the Astros, and he can play a bunch of different positions, including second base. So how do you see those two guys, you know, helping the Red Sox as they're kind of in this? I know they don't want to use this language, but this is a little bit of a bridge year.
Yeah, no, I mean, so Hernandez, yeah, is gonna, you know, I don't think many people expected him to slot into that, you know, leadoff spot. But, you know, Alex Cora is very, very high on him and his ability to be able to hit righties and lefties. The rest, his career numbers, he's always been better against lefties. And Cora's basically just said he's been a utility player his whole career. He hasn't had a chance to hit too much against right-handers. And they've given him that chance this spring, and he kind of showed them that he can take to it. So I think they're keeping him in that spot. And, you know, is this a long-term solution, you know, for, you know, the next 5-10 years? No. You know, Jeter Downs is kind of, you know, waiting in the wings, and he definitely needs more development and more time. He hasn't even played in a minor league game for the Red Sox because the season was canceled last year.
That's unbelievable to think.
It's crazy, right? Yes. Guys from the Mookie Betts trade are still kind of waiting in the wings, and it's kind of wild. But Hernandez should definitely bring them at least a little farther ahead than they were last year in terms of stability at second base and rotating in Jonathan Ruse and, you know, Michael Chavis and Zhuwei Lin and, like, all, you know, any number of guys that kind of rotated through that spot last year. So one thing is the offense that he can bring and kind of that spark and just, you know, at the top of the lineup. He's a tremendous defender, you know, and he's going to be able to give them a lot of flexibility. Like you mentioned, like Marwin, he's going to be playing a lot in center. You know, he can, you know, back up at short. He's played every position, you know, except pitcher. I think he's even caught a game, I think, once in LA. So, or, you know, backed up or something along those lines. They basically got two Brock Holtz on this team in Hernandez and Gonzalez. And Gonzalez is probably going to be more in the outfield and kind of more, you know, platooning and left with Franchi Cordero. But, you know, we'll be able to back up at third, you know, we'll play second base. He's got most of his career games, you know, in the middle infield there. We'll be able to back up at short. So, I mean, even first base, you know, he's really the primary, you know, backup first baseman after Bobby Dalbec. They don't really have too many other guys on the roster that have played that many games. I think, you know, Marwin has like 150 career games at first base. So he's going to be all over the field. So yeah, we mentioned earlier about just adding that depth and flexibility to the roster and in terms of the pitching staff, but these two guys are, you know, going to be really key in just mixing and matching. And it's the main reason why they're allowed, or, you know, why Cora feels okay with going with only 12 position players versus, you know, the 13-13 split. They're going with 14 pitchers and 12 position players this year because they're hoping to have that extra flexibility in the bullpen. And Marwin and Kike can kind of give them that depth with so many positions that they can play that they don't, you know, they can go with a three-man bench.
You mentioned Kike playing center field, and that's the next place I want to talk about with you, because I think a lot of Red Sox fans, it's hard to believe, Jen, that we're only 3 years out basically from the Red Sox winning 108 games and winning the World Series. And we all remember the wind dance repeat outfield, all homegrown guys from left to right, Andrew Benintendi, Jackie Bradley Jr., and of course, Mookie Betts. And now all those guys are gone. And that was one of the strengths of the team, that young outfield. You thought it was going to be a core for years to come. Now I feel like one of the bigger question marks on this team is the outfield. Alex Verdugo was pretty good last year in a short sample size. Center field, we'll see how that goes. Kike could be there sometimes. They have Hunter Renfroe, who strikes out a ton but has some power. And Franchi Cordero, to me, you know, I hope he works out, but it sort of, to me, looks like he's kind of the left-handed Willie Mo Pena. Maybe the good side of Willie Mo, who could hit the ball a million miles but just could never put it together consistently. And as you mentioned, Gonzalez and Kike Hernandez will be out there as well. When you look at the Red Sox in that outfield, just how shocking is it to see that they're basically just piecing it together after they had three guys that you thought were going to be here for a long, long time?
Yeah, it's amazing, to be honest. And I mean, I think that that in and of itself is just kind of a microcosm of what this whole, you know, team and turnover and rebuild is about. The fact that those three aren't here anymore and that this outfield that was the stabilizing force of this team, you know, there's always going to be, you know, issues in the rotation and the bullpen and whatever, you know, and at second base and everywhere else. But the outfield, you took for granted the stability that they had and how good they were, and thought that they were going to be here forever. And now, yeah, like you said, sort of piecing things together. And, you know, one of the early offseason, you know, signings was Hunter Renfroe. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, I mean, good player, but, like, you know, and he's, yeah, he's, you know, again, don't want to read
a strikeout machine. He's, if anybody typifies today's MLB, it's Hunter Renfroe, in that the batting averages are low. He strikes out a ton, but he has power. And I think in today's Major League Baseball, the teams overlook, you know, batting average basically has become meaningless. And they say the strikeouts are part and parcel of getting the power, and they're more than willing to take it. You know, I'm not sure Hunter Renfroe would be a guy that would be considered a starting caliber outfield in Major League Baseball 25 years ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree, you know, and I think part of the, you know, the mix that Heim kind of brought in, it's interesting if you look, you've got kind of the all or nothing guys with Renfroe and Cordero. And then you've got these flexible guys and Gonzalez and Hernandez that are probably going to hit more for, you know, the average or the, you know, the traditional numbers that you look at. And you can probably throw Verdugo into that mix too. And so it's sort of like he kind of intentionally targeted this mix of, you know, all or nothing guys and guys that can kind of, you know, hit for average, but maybe not as much power. So it's going to be fascinating to watch how, you know, who he throws out there on what day and like what his thought process and is and justifying, you know, why he had a certain outfield lineup and if they can even mesh together, because they haven't played that many games, you know, all together, especially Cordero, who only arrived, you know, like mid-March because of all the backups with, you know, COVID and the trade and all that. So yeah, I think that's going to be something that we are going to be talking a lot about this year.
I think, Jen, you stumbled upon the marketing slogan for the 2021 Red Sox. We have two Brock Holtz.
I think that's honestly, you know, I think that's going to be something that we're going to say in a lot this year. You know, I feel like when they both came, you know, signed with the team, it was like, oh, this, they're kind of getting their super utility guy. And then I think it was Kike first. And then like a week or so later, they like got Marwin too. And it was like, okay, like, I guess this is kind of what they're thinking, or, you know, maybe they want two of these guys. And I, you know, in some senses it makes sense, but it is going to be just, I don't know, curious to see how Cora, you know, manages this. Cause there's going to be a lot of, it's not just going to be one lineup every day and that's it. It's going to be a lot of thinking about who fits where and why. And,
but, you know, that's sort of the Tampa Bay model where Heim Bloom comes from. And you see it with Kevin Cash. You saw it before with Joe Maddon. A lot of mixing and matching. I think you guys, the BBWAA official scorebooks, you guys are going to get a workout this year with all the mixing and matching and having to keep score of the games. And I really, for me, the most fascinating thing is the outfield. Because last year, as bad as the Red Sox were, Jen, they still finished third in Major League Baseball in outfield WAR, wins above replacement at 4.9. And that was really good. And Jackie Bradley Jr. had a good year. There wasn't much of a market for him. The only teams that were better in outfield WAR last year were the Dodgers at 5.9. And obviously they have this guy named Mookie Betts. Maybe you've heard of him, and won the World Series. And the New York Mets, who I think have some underrated guys. You know, Brandon Nimmo is one, a guy I've always really liked, and he's there for them. And so when I look at the Red Sox, this speaks to a larger picture question I wanted to ask you about what they're doing and how they're doing it. You've heard some people talk about, well, maybe this could be like 2013 where they sign these sort of bargain veterans and then out of nowhere there's like a World Series. To me, I look at this team and I feel like the real building of this team is happening in the background. It's happening at the minor league level, and they just want a presentable product at their major league level to distract the fans or keep them engaged well enough while in the background Heim builds the real team.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. You know, I think they realize they can't have a nothing product on the major league field. They still, you know, they still have a $200 million payroll and they still need to be able to compete at some level. You know, they can't have another 2020 where they bottom out and everything is awful. So they need to be able to compete at some level and kind of have something at least that's interesting out there for at least just the surface, you know, level fan to be entertained by, and some, you know, interesting people out there on the major league team. But like you said, the real kind of rebuild or retooling of this organization is happening underground behind the scenes in the minor leagues. And you've seen that in so many moves that, you know, Bloom has made over the past year, really since he kind of came in October 2019. It, you know, everybody points to the Mookie Betts, you know, price trade that got Verdugo, Wong, and Downs. But you look at all these moves he's made over the past year. We mentioned, you know, the Moreland, we didn't mention that.
Yeah, you didn't mention the Moreland deal.
Yeah, we mentioned the Workman, you know, Hembree trade with Philly that got them Pivetta and Siebold. He traded shortly thereafter, you know, Moreland to San Diego and got Jason Rosario and Hudson Potts, an outfielder and a third baseman. He traded, I think, Kevin Pillar and got a right-handed kind of reliever, Jacob Wallace, that's going to be, you know, potentially in the pipeline at some point. He traded, obviously, Andrew Benintendi, and still we don't even know four of the prospects that are coming back in that return, or three more. I can't
players
can't remember
to be named
their
later.
Name.
Yeah.
He's made so many of these moves over the past year that have kind of brought back pieces of this farm system that he's been tasked with sort of rebuilding. And you know, Red Sox fans don't like being patient. They want to see, you know, it's all about what have you done for me lately? And the team hasn't done much for them lately. So it's hard to kind of see the fruits of the labor that's kind of been going on behind the scenes, and they're going to They're going to have to see it, you know, see it out throughout the course this year, especially when the minor league season starts. I think that's going to be huge for them and seeing how some of these guys start performing.
So you mentioned patience and Red Sox fans' patience. Do you think ownership has the patience for this? Because they have rolled through general managers, and I know Heim's technical title is chief baseball officer, but he is the de facto general manager. That's basically same job, different title. I love what Tampa does. There's no question it's successful. I think they're the best run organization in baseball, Jen. I've said it for years. They are the real money ball without sort of the matinee idol of Billy Beane being played by Brad Pitt. I mean, nobody does more with less than the Rays, and I like what they do. But at the same time, I just question whether ownership has the patience for this. And I also look at Bloom, and I want to see a little more Andrew Friedman and a little less Tampa Bay Rays way. And one of the things I'd point to is Jackie Bradley Jr. Like, the contract he signed with Milwaukee is essentially a one-year deal for like $10 or $11 million. The Red Sox could have done that deal, stuck Jackie in center field, and bought the time for Jaron Duran to be ready. You know, I don't really see the Red Sox with the resources they have finishing in last place and having sort of the small market mentality. You look at Bloom's actions, and it's very much a small market mentality. So, again, my question is, do you think ownership has the patience to see this sort of small market mentality build in the background plan through?
Look, I don't think they would have brought Bloom. Like, they knew who they were getting in Bloom. They weren't, you know, they weren't hiring Brian Cashman. You know, I think that they know what they were getting themselves into, and they did it intentionally. They hired Dave Dombrowski for a reason, because he's a guy that, you know, trades off all the prospects and is a win now.
He's like human Red Bull. He's like Red Bull for any, like you get an immediate kick and it feels good. You have so much energy. You're like, I can do anything. And then when it wears off, you look at your team, you're like, oh man, I feel terrible.
Right. And so I think, that's a perfect analogy. I think I think that they were intentional in this hire, and that, you know, just as they were with Dombrowski. I mean, I think Bloom is here for a reason, and they wanted to try to, you know, rebuild, you know, and be, have this more sustainable roster, you know, which they keep pointing to. And you mentioned the Dodgers, and that's sort of kind of the gold standard here, is to try to do what they did, and try to kind of follow their model. And I know everyone, you know, Bloom's coming from Tampa and has that on his resume, but that so did Friedman, and kind of, you know, he worked for so long, Bloom did, under Friedman when Friedman was at the Rays, that I think, you know, a lot of this is rubbed off. And you know, it's what, a year and a half into Bloom's tenure here, if that, you know, a little shy of a year and a half. He's done so much of this rebuild that we've talked about over the past 18 months or so. And now it's kind of like, I think, at the crest, and like, we need to start seeing some results. I think, you know, like I said, I think they brought him in for a reason. He's not going to have, you know, a 10-year leash on this thing, but I think that he, you know, laid out his plan, and they probably wouldn't have hired him if they didn't, you know, trust in this process and trust in this plan. It just, you know, they are, you know, too, I feel like, just too focused on the front facing product of the team. And I don't think that they want to be, you know, this you know, kind of laughing stock of baseball, you know, like they were.
Well, they were irrelevant
year.
In their own market last year, which is right. The worst thing the Red Sox can be. They became irrelevant.
Yeah. And it obviously it all comes down to money and, you know, people not wanting to watch the games on NESN. So it can't be, this product can't be, you know, something out there for too long. So, you know, people say, you know, this is, you know, a 5-year plan. No, I don't think this is going to, you know, it can't take that long, because they can't afford it to take that long. And I think Bloom must have laid out some plan to them of like, look, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I'm planning to do. And maybe in year 2 or 3, you know, we'll start to see the fruits of some of this labor here. And then it'll start moving kind of in a more winning direction. And this year is sort of kind of this is the crucial year of, you know, is some of this actually going to work this year? I don't think they would have brought him in, you know, if they weren't going to give him a couple years to figure this out.
So the ideal model for this would be Theo Epstein. He was the general manager who was able to win at the major league level and still build a really strong minor league. Theo is no longer in baseball. He's now working for Major League Baseball. When I say no longer in baseball, he's no longer in a GM role. He left the Cubs. Now he's working for MLB, and he's trying to change some rules. So Ellen has a thought about sort of where the game is at and some of the work that Theo's doing.
Right. Well, I mean, while we're on the subject of patience, I'm I am that viewer of baseball that doesn't have any. I think the games are far too long, and they're just getting more and more boring. If you're not at the actual game, there's not really enough excitement to keep you engaged and off your phone and off all the other things that are around you and distracting you. And so I wanted to know, like, what are your thoughts on some of the rule changes that they're putting in place and scattering throughout the minor leagues? And are there any that you think will help with that? Or are there any that are just absolutely ridiculous? I personally think the automatic ball strike robot ump is like, that weirds me out. I don't love that.
That's my dream. First of all, the robots are 100% taking over. It's their world now, not ours. There's drones. You saw during the pandemic, like, they had those weird, like, robots marching in, like, Hong Kong, basically being like, have you been vaccinated? Like, whatever. Yes. So it's like, it's their world now, not ours. And if there's one part of baseball I don't like, it's how sort of capricious the strike zone is. So I'm all about the robot umps, but go ahead.
Okay, see, I like that the strike zone is capricious
No.
I like, do you know how many games people have won because the umps?
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying.
It goes both ways.
Yeah, I want, bring on the robots. Humans are not fit to call balls and strikes.
I want to know, do you think that? Do you like the robots? Do you like the bigger bases? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I know. It's just like mind-boggling to see baseball, you know, that's been this sport that's so stuck in its ways and so, you know, traditional and America's pastime and all that, you know, for 100 and so years, now starting to kind of get gimmicky, I guess, if you will, in some of these things that they're doing with, yeah, the bigger bases, the strike zone with potentially, you know, robots and the pitch clock and, you know, starting a runner on second and extra innings. That's actually one that I don't mind. I think that was in place last year, if I'm not mistaken. And that's actually something that I think kind of, you know, created some urgency in extra innings instead of having, you know, like 25 extra innings and, you know, things are slogging along. So, I mean, some of them
just
are
going to... Just be honest, Jen, you baseball writers have dinner reservations and you want to get to them.
Oh, yeah. Especially nowadays, right? Dinner reservations, you know, back at home. But I think some of them will end up sticking, maybe like a pitch clock. You know, we've seen some of that, and that's being implemented more in the minors. And just, you know, especially, yeah, over the last few years up here in between innings, I think those are kind of things that can create a little bit more urgency. So it's not, you know, a guy standing on the mound for 30 seconds before he throws a pitch. But yeah, I don't think you want to get too far away from the main product, because then it just, like I said, becomes a little, like, I don't know, cringy and gimmicky of like, what is this? Like, this is kind of like a weird, you know, dunk contest that you're trying to, like, you know, create some like excitement, but it's like fabricated, like false kind of excitement. I think it's just going to be a matter of, you know, which ones the players kind of take to and which ones don't necessarily disrupt the flow of the game too much, if that makes sense. Or, you know, I know a lot of them are made to quicken the game, but I think, you know, the ones that just feel more natural, I think will end up sticking more.
So I think baseball's future hinges upon them being able to get Ellen to turn away from a housewives reunion to watch the Red Sox. I think that is what the sport hinges on.
I think the NFL has done a really good job of making a very long game very exciting. And to your point, that does involve gimmicks. I mean, I find
The Nickelodeon things,
everything. Pro days are exciting. The draft is exciting. Like,
great
things
point,
that
Ellen,
really
yeah.
shouldn't. That I remember growing up watching the draft with my dad, and now it's a full out. I mean, it's like the Oscars. The Red Sox baseball at the end of the day is like, have you ever been to a Bruce Springsteen concert?
I have not.
It's an absolute blast. But then, like, the lights turn on and he's still playing, and, like, you just want to go home at that point. And it's like, it's time, Bruce. Like, this is a weeknight. We got things to do tomorrow. Like, I'm all here for it, but we got it. We have things to do.
I could,
like,
see that.
Like, a little nostalgic product, too, you know? Yeah.
That's a great point, Jen. I mean, I think one of the things, like, for me with baseball, and in just talking with the two of you, you know, it's not just the time of game, which obviously, you know, a Red Sox-Yankees game can be interminable. I mean, you literally feel like time is being rewound. It's like Thanos and, like, the Avengers, like, rewinding time. But also it's the action. You know, there's just not as much action. And I know Theo wants to get more of that in there. We've sort of fallen into this three true outcomes world where it's like, okay, you know, it's either a home run, a strikeout, or a walk. And my whole thing about baseball, you know, to both of you, has been over the years, as analytics has become better and more precise, they've created a much more efficient product. But more efficient is not necessarily more entertaining. And I think that's the problem that Theo is dealing with. You sort of have competing mandates. You know, these teams want to win, and what's going to win isn't necessarily the most entertaining thing for the fans.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, another thing is kind of like, should they ban the shift and that whole thing? And that obviously was created in order to, you know, try to game the system a little bit and, you know, putting the shift on to you know, get guys to hit into it and you know, try to get guys out that way. So, I mean, banning the shift obviously creates, you know, people are trying to create more offense, but that also maybe makes the games longer and, you know, takes away a little bit of a competitive advantage. So it is, yeah, the balance there of creating a watchable product that's not boring the fans and holding their attention versus, you know, like the product itself and quickening the game and also just keeping to, you know, the standards of what baseball actually is. It's a balance. And I think, you know, like kind of like you were mentioning, bringing in Theo Epstein and kind of bringing in these people that, you know, have been around the game for a while and helped, you know, form the game that is nowadays is sort of, I think, their thought process and like, how can we do this but still stay true to what we have? So I don't know. I don't know where the future of where this is all going to go. But I mean, in one sense, I guess it's good that they're at least trying to do something about, you know, pace of play and all that business. That's one positive.
Yeah, I would agree. And so what they should do is what they did when the All-Star game was formed. They should go to the baseball writers and solicit ideas from them. It was a baseball writer in Chicago who came up with the idea for the MLB All-Star game. I don't know if people know that. I also don't know if they know, Jen, that you are the chapter, the Boston chapter chair of the BBWAA, the Baseball Writers Association of America. And so I was just sort of curious, what has it been like for you guys in the BBWAA, just sort of trying to work with MLB during the pandemic to make sure you guys can still do your jobs and do them safely, and also the players are safe? Because for anyone who's ever covered baseball, and I've done it a little bit, not nearly as much as you, but really the lifeblood of covering a baseball game is being in the clubhouse, is talking to the players. And you guys can't do that during the pandemic. So what has it been like sort of working with them to try and make sure you guys can do your job and the players can do theirs and everybody can stay safe and you guys can still cover and promote the game?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's definitely like for everybody over this past year, it's been a huge change and challenge of trying to do your job, you know, so differently than what you're used to. And like you said, the whole purpose of this job is to sort of be around and to observe and talk to people in person so that you can kind of relay stories and, you know, observations to the fans that aren't there. And when you don't have the access anymore, or so limited access, it's a problem. And I mean, obviously this is all in light of, you know, a much more massive problem in the world, you know, that we're dealing with, and people are dealing with things that are much more stressful and painful than, you know, covering baseball and not being able to be there. But just in the context of this conversation, yeah, I mean, there's been plenty of conversations, you know, over the past year of, you know, when can we start to get back, you know, in-person access? And do we have, you know, vaccine databases to prove reporters are vaccinated to, you know, once the players get vaccinated to show that, yes, we can both be in person, even if it is outside for, you know, this year, until things get more safe, and that kind of thing. Yeah, there's been so many different discussions over the past, you know, few months, especially when spring training started. You know, every team sort of operates a little differently. Boston has a very large media base, and, you know, a lot of these cities have much smaller media bases, so they only have a couple, you know, reporters, so it's easier for them to do things in person at a distance, masked outside, all that. Whereas in Boston, you know, there's what, you know, 20 beat reporters, 18 beat reporters, and then plus, you know, a dozen TV reporters that are kind of around the team on a daily basis. You know, you can look at New York and Chicago and sort of say the same thing. So it's kind of different market to market. We've just had, yeah, a lot of conversations over the past year of what makes sense, you know, being patient, obviously being safe first and foremost, and hoping that maybe by, you know, the All-Star break, things will start to be, you know, the world will be a little bit safer, knock on wood, hopefully by then.
Do you foresee, for anybody who's ever been in there or hasn't been in there, you know, the Red Sox have a very, very cramped clubhouse because Fenway's old. It's built in 1912. and they've done a lot of renovations, but it's still a very cramped space for a lot of people. So is maybe the move this year the idea that maybe after batting practice, you guys can do socially distanced interviews or something on the field? Is that the idea?
Yeah. So I think that's kind of the hope, is that, you know, so in previous years, like in a normal year, we'd have about an hour or 45 minutes to be in the clubhouse and talk to players in the clubhouse. But a lot of times they're getting treatment or, you know, kind of have another responsibility somewhere else. So they're not in there. Then we can go out after talking to, you know, the manager, we can go out to the field for batting practice and kind of wait around near the dugout and get a guy after he's done taking his batting practice that's heading back into the field. And honestly, that's more often than not where you end up getting a guy, because he's kind of done with his pregame stuff and he has a little bit more time. So that's the hope. You know, I don't think we're going to be back in the clubhouse this year, just because of the space constraints. And, you know, even at this point, the players themselves are back in the clubhouse this year, you know, and they're not in those suites, those corporate suites like they were last year. So I don't think, you know, we're going to be getting into the clubhouse anytime soon. But if we can get down onto the field and talk to players on the field, and, you know, you just lose so much over, you know, over a phone call or over a Zoom call. You don't get necessarily a player's truest reaction, or, like, you know, can't read their body language as well, or like when you're asking them a question, or kind of can't just get those cues that you're, you know, used to having when you talk to someone. So I think being able to have these in-person conversations once things are safer, and maybe, you know, in a couple months down the road, that's kind of the goal for this year, and kind of, you know, fingers crossed that comes sooner than later.
If there's ever a conversational coverage sport, it's certainly baseball. A lot of it built on having human interaction and face-to-face conversations. We'll get you out on this, because we're in danger of this podcast running longer than the Red Sox-Yankees game at this point. But what is your prediction record-wise for the 2021 Red Sox? And I preface it by saying I think we're all excited Alex Cora is back, but everybody seems to remember only 2018 and forget that he did manage the team in 2019. And the last time he managed the team, they were 84-78 in third place. My expectations for them are about 85 wins. What are yours?
I was honestly, well, I think in that season preview, I put 85 wins. I think if it's so interesting to think about that 29 season, that was such a disappointment with when they went 84-78. If they went 84-78 this season, I think most fans would be happy with that. You know, I don't think people are expecting much more than that. People are expecting them to be like a 75 win team, an 81-81 team. I think that they'll be slightly better than 500. They're not going to win the division. They're not going to compete with the Yankees. The Yankees are just too strong. You know, Tampa obviously is what Tampa is. I mean, they've had some turnover in their rotation, and they always have a little bit of, you know, a hole in their lineup, but they're still going to be the Tampa Bay Rays and a tough, you know, tough competition. And then you've got the Jays, who are so much stronger this year, and seems like their homegrown core is kind of coming into its own. Maybe they end up squeaking into the finals, you know, second wild card spot. But, you know, you've got the Twins in the Central, and the White Sox are strong, and, you know, the A's out West, and Houston. So, I mean, like, there's a lot of strong teams out there. So, I mean, I think the perception is just going to be funny to see if they end up with, you know, 84 wins this year. It'll be like, oh, okay. Like, maybe this team is actually better than we thought when 84 wins, you know, in 2019 after the World Series in 18 was brutal.
Well, sometimes the Red Sox do their best work when the expectations are lowered. So maybe they'll do that this year. You certainly met our expectations here on the Take 5 podcast, Jen. Thanks for coming on. It was fantastic. That's Jen McCaffrey of The Athletic. You can catch her work there on The Athletic. I recommend you get a subscription. It is certainly worth the cost. And you can also see her on Twitter. She's at JC McCaffrey. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. We appreciate it, as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.